This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, as we all are, right? Oh, my, so much in the program today. How's that new Gilded Age treating you? We're going to talk about that, the Florida Panhandle, what's going on down there. Trump is flying down there after apparently playing golf over the weekend. How do we un-Trump the world? Anand Giridharadas. I'm going to have to practice that last name. I think it's Giridharadas. Anand Giridharadas is going to be with us about Silicon Valley, Saudi Arabia problem. He also has a new book out about how, you know, basically the elite are, you know, the Davos crowd are saying, oh, we're going to solve the problems of the world. And by and large, they're solving problems that they created, and they're not really solving them. It's just this whole thing. And about that'll be at the beginning of the second hour of the program. And Tom Perez is going to drop by at the bottom of the hour. And Nick Guthman with the Progressive Blue Future Group is going to be with us in this hour. So, you know, a lot coming up today. But let's start out, you know, with the new Gilded Age, this whole idea that, you know, that era from, you know, late 1870s through the crash of 1896, I think, largely, was considered the Gilded Age. And then, you know, when conservatives ran things of, by, and for business, and the fat cats who basically controlled Congress and everything else were people like Jay Gould, the railroad baron, John Rockefeller, the oil baron, Mr. Mellon, I'm forgetting his first name, who was the banking baron, and, you know, basically these guys, and who became Herbert Hoover's Treasury Secretary, as I recall. And you know, these guys ran the world, basically, or ran the United States. And then, of course, there was the Progressive Era, right after the assassination of McKinley in 1901, when Teddy Roosevelt became president, and Taft after him, two relatively progressive Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt brought us the national parks and the inheritance tax, and, you know, all kinds of good stuff. But the hallmarks, the kind of signature hallmarks of the Gilded Age and the Roaring Twenties, these two eras in our past, where corporations basically rose up and took over everything from, you know, the average working person's life, you know, through a whole variety of mechanisms, including Supreme Court decisions. This was the era, the Roaring Twenties was the era of the Lochner Court, where they struck down child labor laws, they struck down unionization, the right to unionize, they struck down the rights of individual workers, basically to have any say at all in the workplace. And today, right, we've got these three eras that were all governed by conservatives. Now, in the Gilded Age, the conservatives called themselves Democrats because the Republicans were the anti-slavery party, although they kind of got into the same bed there for a while. And in fact, Grover Cleveland was the only Democrat who was elected president during that entire period from the end of the Civil War until after Taft, you know, with Woodrow Wilson. And Cleveland was elected president as a Democrat twice with a Republican in between, which is very interesting. But, and Cleveland gave lip service to it. You know, you've heard me quote on this program in the past numerous times from his, I believe it's 1887 State of the Union address, where he talked about, you know, corporations and the wealthy have risen in power to the point where the iron heel of corporations is upon the neck of the average working citizen. So, and you can, you know, Google that or look it up. It's in a bunch of op-eds that I've written, too. You can easily find it by searching on my name and, you know, Grover Cleveland. But here we are again, right? I mean, the signature, the hallmark characteristic of these three eras, the one we're currently in, the Gilded Age, the late 1800s, and the Roaring Twenties from 1920 to 1929, the probably the two singular hallmarks of those eras are, number one, the very rich, and I'm talking the top 1% to the top 1/100th of 1%, got insanely rich. While working people either got flat, you know, either their wages were flat or they actually declined. That happened in all three of these eras. But the other piece of it, which is why everybody got rich outside of just tax policy, is mergers and acquisitions. Trusts is what they were referred to back in the 19th century and the early 20th century. And that's why Teddy Roosevelt was so successful, so effective from 1901 till, 1908 when he was president, by being the trust buster, in quotes. I mean, he broke up these big corporations, most famously Standard Oil of Ohio, or Standard Oil of New Jersey, actually, it was by that point in time. It started out in Ohio, and they threw Rockefeller out in the 1890s, and then you had this charter-mongering era where all the states on the East Coast were competing to reduce the standards of a corporation had to meet in order to charter itself in their state, including the antitrust standards. And New Jersey ended up with Rockefeller's business. Delaware ended up the most successful. But anyhow, that led to this explosion of mergers and these trusts. And here we are again. Trump's Justice Department just approved a $69 billion merger between CVS, the nation's largest drugstore chain, and one of the five largest health insurance companies. And I'm not sure where they rank in that five, but Aetna. And I'm pretty sure Aetna is where, I'm not certain of that, so I'm not going to go down that road. But anyway, this is the largest health insurance deal in history. And, you know, the purpose, Robert Reich is writing about this over on his blog at robertreich.org. He says the real purpose is to give Aetna and CVS more bargaining power over their consumers and employees, right? I mean, you know, if this new giant company is the biggest drugstore chain in town and the biggest insurance company in town, and they're setting wage floors or ceilings, actually. This is sort of like, you know, the old Gilded Age in England, in the United Kingdom, that Dickens wrote about, when there were literally, and this was, you know, from the 1700s to through the end of the 1800s, end of the 19th century, there were literally laws that were called maximum wage laws. Employers couldn't pay their employees over a certain amount because they did not want a middle class to emerge. Because as Russell Kirk talked about in his famous book, The Conservative Mind, in 1951, the book that kicked off the modern conservative movement, if you have a middle class, it is disruptive. A middle class means that, you know, people will have political power. They will not be afraid for their lives and their jobs. And middle classes are bad things in the conservatives' worldview. So this is what's going on right now. It's suppressing wages. It's suppressing competition. It's making it impossible to compete. And it's not just CVS. It's not just pharmaceuticals. And so, you know, my question to you is, what do we do about this? And how do we do it? Because A, you've got the Supreme Court has involved itself in this, and B, basically since 1983 with Reagan, we have not been enforcing our antitrust laws. In fact, Nixon was the last guy to do this. He broke up AT&T. It took a while. The final unwinding of AT&T happened when Jimmy Carter was president, but Richard Nixon was the one who initiated it. And that was really the last big time. You got the five banks in the United States now hold 44% of all American banking assets, all American banking assets. And, you know, just 30 years ago, they only controlled 10%. So, you know, we're seeing the same thing on the internet with Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, all these kind of things. As Robert Reich notes, you know, ever wonder why your airline tickets are so high? Well, you know, it's because, you know, even though the price of jet fuel was really low there for a couple of years, it's coming back up again now that oil's up to $75 a barrel, but oil was around $45 a barrel for a long time. Jet fuel got really, really cheap. And did you see a decrease in your ticket price? No, what you saw was massive, profit things from the airlines, right? Because they don't have to compete with each other. They basically, with the hub and spoke system, they've got you nailed down. And in fact, it was interesting. I was at a meeting of the Vocal Board. VOQAL.org is the website. It's a philanthropic organization that I'm on the board of directors of, and talking to people about, you know, everybody was going home Sunday afternoon, right? And I flew nonstop back to Portland. On United, I fly United a lot, but there were other people who, you know, there's one person who was flying back to Portland on Alaska Airlines going through Seattle, right, just to get the miles. It's like the airlines have us locked down. And then you look at this, you know, Monsanto alone owns the key genetic traits to more than 90% of the soybeans planted by farmers in the United States and 80% of the corn. Tell me this isn't a monopoly. The four largest food processing companies control 82% of beef packing, 85% of soybean processing, 63% of pork processing, 53% of chicken processing. And, you know, on and on and on this goes. This is the literally the new Gilded Age. And at the same time, we are using tax policy to supercharge this, to make this, you know, to give these big corporations even more money that they can use for mergers, and also to widen the racial wealth divide. The Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, ITEP, just released this amazing new report. This is the first quantitative analysis to actually look at the racial consequences of the Republican tax scam. And what they point out is that because the, you know, about 80% of all the benefits went to the top 1%, the top 1% are three times more likely to be people of color, or excuse me, white people, than is the general population. So, as a consequence, white families are three times the benefit. Households of color are largely excluded from any benefits from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act benefits. This, you know, the Republican tax scam. And meanwhile, we've got this rigged system to keep it in place. And I want to get into that when we come back from the break. This is, you know, we've talked with Greg Palast a number of times about this. He's got some brand new information out, you know, about Nevada. And it's real interesting, and we will get into that too. So, you know, your thoughts on the new Gilded Age, how do we get out of this? Historically, by the way, just, you know, as a point of reference, the way that we've gotten out of these Gilded Ages in the past is through massive crashes. The Great Crash of 1896, the Great Crash of 1929.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Is it going to be the Great Crash of 2018 or 2019 or 2020? Who knows? I mean, Trump is trying to hold it off as long as he can, but it's coming to a town near you. And welcome back. Linda in Auburn, Washington. Hey, Linda, what's on your mind today?
Hi. You were talking about...
I can barely hear you, Linda. I don't know if Sean needs to turn you up or you need to turn you up, but I can barely hear you. What's up?
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay. You were talking about corporations and how they are, you know, overly in control. And my suggestion is, it's another out-of-the-box idea, but there is a law that we have that I believe could help us if, and so it has to do with taking the power away from the corporations and steering everything in a really good direction. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with looking at the Declaration of Independence as a primary, like a preamble to the Constitution. And that the original colonists were trying to set up a country under God. And if we would look at that as a preamble, and I know there's a concern about hierarchy, but actually on the spiritual level, it's not male or female. So we can look at it like even one translation of God is self-existent one.
But Linda, there's no reference to God in any of the founding documents. The one nation under God, indivisible with liberty and justice for all, the under God part was added in 1954 as a way of trying to basically slap the Soviets because they, you know, atheism was an official part of communist ideology. And it was part of the anti-communist, whipping up the anti-communist thing. The founders, in fact, two different places in the Constitution specifically said, God's got nothing to do with this country. You can't have a religious test for office, and there shall be no official religion in the United States. In fact, while people's rights to engage in religion shall not be impaired, religion shall not impair the U.S. government. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, but, you know, it's right there in the First Amendment, and it's in the Establishment Clause. Congress shall establish no religion.
I don't think that's true because
it is absolutely true.
Original.
You have a bunch of the founders who were even atheists. Thomas Paine wrote a book about atheism, The Age of Reason. George Washington refused to say whether he was Christian. James Madison was a Protestant, but he was, you know, he didn't go to church very often. Thomas Jefferson was a deist. Ben Franklin was a deist. These guys ridiculed the religious. They worked very, very hard to keep religion out of it. In fact, James Madison, his first veto was as president in 1809, he vetoed a piece of legislation that would have moved the funding of the poorhouses in Washington, D.C. out of the federal budget and instead allocated money from the federal budget to give to the churches in Washington, D.C. to run the poorhouses. James Madison vetoed it, saying that there's no place for religion in American government.
Am I still on the line? I don't know if I can
you are.
Speak now. Okay, well, I have a copy of the Declaration of Independence, and it does say, you know, under God, so...
Yeah, but the Declaration of Independence is not a legal document. It's...
Well, I'm trying to... If I could speak a little longer, I'm trying to help us not have corporations run things.
But if you're trying to do that using God, Linda, it's not going
to
work. Linda, I'm sorry, we're out of time. Interesting theory. Anyway, we'll be back. Welcome back. The Democratic Coalition just reported that the Georgia Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, has been reported to the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division for Voting Rights Act violations. The Trump Justice Department says, yeah, so what, right? Jeff Sessions runs it. So you want to purge some people. Stacey Abrams had tweeted, feels like deja vu. 4 years ago, Kemp tried to keep 40,000 new voters off the rolls. It took a few years, but we beat him. A few months ago, he tried to close polling places, but we beat him there too. Now he's at it again, and we'll beat him again. You know, he's sitting on 52,000 registrations right now, refusing to put them into the system. Keep in mind, the last Georgia gubernatorial election was won by about 100,000 votes. So if Kemp can take, you know, more than half of that and swing it away from the Democrat and toward him, he's governor, which is obviously why Kemp is doing this. But now we learn from Greg Palast that, you know, it's not just Brian Kemp in Georgia. He's the one that's acceptable to talk about in the corporate media. But, you know, Greg Palast just got the names of 90,000 residents of Las Vegas and Reno. And, you know, we're on the air in both towns. This is Clark and Washoe counties. Were purged from the voting rolls, 90,000 people. And Nevada is a battleground state. You know, the Republican Dean Heller is running for re-election, and he's got a really strong challenger. And forgive me, I don't have that person's name right at the tip of my tongue. But if you're in Nevada or you know anybody in Nevada, go to gregpalast.com and you can see the list. The other big one, and this, you know, hey, heads up to our listeners at WCPT in Chicago and the other stations associated with WCPT. Greg Palast has the Illinois purge list. Yes, you had a Republican governor there, and he has purged apparently 550,000 voters from the voting rolls in Illinois. So again, you can go to gregpalast.com and you can just plug your name in and see if you have been purged from the voting rolls in the state of Illinois. And Indiana, Greg Palast finally got, I mean, he's been suing these states, right? There's 27 Republican-controlled states that are all aggressively purging their voting rolls. And I mean, you know, if you live in California, New York, or Oregon, or Washington State, this is not an issue. But if you live in one of these red states, one of these Republican-controlled states, and you want to vote Democratic, or you live in one of the big cities, or you have an African-American last name or a Hispanic last name, you know, one of the 10, 20 most common last names for both of those ethnic groups, and Asians as well. If, you know, odds are pretty good. I mean, you know, not 50-50 or 90%, but odds are probably 10, 15%. That you're no longer on the voting rolls. And in Indiana, he found that they illegally purged 90,000 people. And again, you can see the list over at gregpalast.com. So the Georgia list, the Indiana list, the Illinois list, and the Nevada list are all now up at gregpalast.com, and it's really worth checking out. And finally, this, not finally, I mean, there's still so much more news, and I'll be getting to your phone calls right after the break about what you think we can do about this outside of, or beyond just voting Democrats in, or do we need to get Democrats in? And in fact, actually, right after the break, Tom Perez is going to be with us, and I will ask him that question. But the last piece here, the White House has finally admitted, after lying about this for over a year now, Wilbur Ross saying, oh yeah, we're going to put the citizenship question on the census, which of course is going to cause any Hispanic family in America who even has one member of their family who's living anywhere in the neighborhood who's not a legal U.S. citizen to freak out and not fill out the census, which means they're going to end up underrepresented, getting fewer federal dollars, all those kind of things, and less representation in Congress. It now comes out, now that they've got the emails, now that the Freedom of Information Act, they've actually got this, they nailed this, that it was Steve Bannon and Chris Kobach who came up with this idea. The Steve Bannon who says, you know, racism, let's embrace the racists. Chris Kobach, who's running this racist voter suppression scheme called Interstate Crosscheck, they're the ones who came up with the idea and gave it to Wilbur Ross. So now we know, right? We'll be back with your calls after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
It is coming up on in about a half a minute, 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom Perez is on the line with us. He's the chair of the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. He's the former U.S. Secretary of Labor, among other things. Democrats.org is the website. You can tweet him at Tom Perez, P-E-R-E-Z. Secretary Perez, welcome, or Chairman Perez, welcome back to the program. Mr. Perez, is on hybrid one, hybrid two, both of them up?
We only have one.
Yeah. Tom Perez? Hello? Sure, I'm going to put him on hold, and if you can pick up the line and see when he's available, because it shows that he's sitting on line 10. Shira, can you hear me? Okay, you got it. Thank you. Meanwhile, the smoking gun, the White House finally admits, I was talking about this during, just before the break, that this is Josh Marshall was writing about this. He says, big deal. He said, so the white nationalists, Bannon and Kobach, are the guys behind the plan to rig the census to disenfranchise blue state voters. Ari Berman, the journalist who has a show on MSNBC, he's calling this the smoking gun. He says, this is the smoking gun showing that Steve Bannon and Chris Kobach pushed the citizenship question on the 2020 census. It had nothing to do with voting Rights Act. It was all about suppressing immigrant. Oh, he's there? Immigrant votes. Great. Thank you. I introduced you just a minute ago, but I'll say it again. Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC, the former U.S. Secretary of Labor, Democrats.org. You can tweet him at Tom Perez. Secretary Perez, Chairman Perez, great to have you back with us.
Oh, please call me Tom. It's always good to be on your show, Tom. And you were talking about Steve Bannon and the citizenship question. As someone who led the Civil Rights Division, the notion that they needed that information for Voting Rights Act enforcement purposes is categorically, I'll say, just false.
This is the lie that Wilbur Ross was putting out when, in fact, he was dancing to the tune of the racists and literally, Steve Bannon says, use racism, it's a good thing, the racists in the White House. It's pretty mind-boggling.
Absolutely. And right now, as we speak, the person who handled the voting docket when I led the Civil Rights Division is now in the senior leadership of the New York Attorney General's office, and he is the lead lawyer on the case that is in federal court in New York City involving this the illegality of asking the question. And the issue before the Supreme Court, as we speak, is whether they will be allowed to depose Wilbur Ross. Now, it's a high bar that you have to surmount to depose a sitting cabinet secretary. That is the well-settled law. Right. But when you find out that the cabinet secretary has lied, you have surmounted it. And he should absolutely be allowed to be deposed.
But if the
find that out within the next week.
Yeah, and if the Supreme Court says, no, you can't depose him, then I think we can infer from that that they're also going to say, no, you can't depose the president if you have evidence that he's committed crimes, which is the position that Brett Kavanaugh took in his law review paper that got him, you know, at the top of Donald Trump's list. Do I have that right?
I wouldn't bet against that, Tom.
Yeah,
because,
okay.
It struck me that his... that theater, and that's the most charitable word I can think of his testimony, that he had an audience of one there, and that audience was Donald Trump.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to you about voter purges. Greg Palast just yesterday or the day before, just released the list from Nevada of, 90,000 people just in Las Vegas and Reno and Clark and Washoe counties have been purged from the voting rolls in the last year. He's got the list on his website at gregpalast.com, and we've had listeners all over the country checking these lists out, particularly the Georgia list, which he's had for about a week, and finding their own names on them and calling into this show outraged. He has the list of the 550,000 voters who were purged in the state of Illinois, and he has the list of the 90,000 voters who were purged in Indiana on his website. What are we doing about this?
Yeah, I mean, that's why it's so important for people to plan ahead before they vote. We have a website, iwillvote.com, and we can help with that. We have an 800 number, 833-DEM-VOTE, that we've set up. Don't wait until Election Day to get out there and vote and learn that shenanigans have taken place. One of the ground zeros right now of voter suppression is down in Georgia, where Brian Kemp, whom I sued when I led the Civil Rights Division because he was a practitioner of voter suppression. And
this was years ago. This was like 4 or 5 years ago, right?
Oh, I sued him in like 2011, I think it was. You know, because you and I have talked about this. You've played the 41-second tape from Paul Weyrich.
Oh, yeah.
They want less people to vote. And that's the key. And what they're trying to do in Georgia, for the benefit of your listeners, they enacted a voter ID law. It was upheld. And so what did progressives do? We made sure that people had their IDs. What else happened? The New Georgia Project, which was a remarkable initiative led by Stacey Abrams, who's going to make history, by the way, in 22 days. She led an effort to register eligible voters in Georgia. They registered over 200,000. And so what did the Republicans do? They enacted a new bar, and now they've enacted a requirement that if it isn't a perfect match between your form of ID and what you have on the voter roll, then you can't vote.
Right.
And let me give you an example. You know, if your name is Thomas Perez Jr. and your driver's license says Thomas Perez, Jr., and the voter roll says Thomas Perez Jr., the absence of a comma keeps you disenfranchised. Well, what's going on.
And the more common one is this, you know, like my name is Thomas Carl Hartman. So if I said Thomas C. period Hartman in one place and Thomas C. Hartman in another place, that's not a perfect match, according to Brian Kemp. And I would be thrown off the voting rolls. And I lived in Georgia for 13 years, never had a problem voting, but that was back in the 80s. Forgive my interruption. Back to you, sir.
Right. No, but here's the drill. The reason they made this BS up is because the list of voters, and there's 50,000 potentially disenfranchised voters on this list, and 70% of them are African American. And so you have a benchmark, 30% of voters in Georgia are African American. 70% of voters potentially disenfranchised are African American. This is textbook voter suppression. This is a textbook violation of the Voting Rights Act. This is a violation of the Constitution. This is a violation, frankly, of the motor voter law. And that's why a lawsuit has been filed. And this is just the next chapter of voter suppression, which is why it is so critical for listeners before the election to get online. You can go to I Will Vote. You can call that number I mentioned, 833-DEM-VOTE. And make sure you are registered and make sure that all your stuff is in order because they're going to try to make it hard. That's their only way to win because they're wrong on all the issues. And you saw Kemp's outrageous ads in the Republican primary. You know, he wants to make it harder for African Americans and Latinos to vote, and he should resign, quite frankly. It's unconscionable
as Secretary of State, yeah.
Secretary of State is able to run for governor. This is, you know, to say this is the fox guarding the hen house is a disservice to all foxes.
Well, Chris Kobach just did this in Kansas too. I mean,
exactly.
this is not something new, and it's not just a violation of all these various laws. It's also a violation of basically the principles of small d democracy all the way back to the days of Athens, and you know, just blatantly a violation of that. Now, we're talking to Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC. If the five Republican appointees, the five conservatives on the U.S. Supreme Court, had not chosen to gut the Voting Rights Act, which was renewed by Congress. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think it was
almost
98
unanimous.
To nothing.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. 98 yes. to nothing. There were two people didn't vote. And so obviously the will of Congress was there. In fact, they addressed that. They said, oh, well, people in Congress were afraid to vote against it because they didn't want to be called racists. But we don't care if we're called racists because we don't get reelected. So we're just going to strike this sucker down, or at least a good chunk of it. Had the Supreme Court not gutted the Voting Rights Act, would Georgia have been able to do this?
No, and that's a really good question. Probably one of the two or three worst days of my tenure in the Obama administration was in 2013. When the Supreme Court, in a case out of Alabama,
Shelby County,
gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act. So what would have happened if the Voting Rights Act were still in place is that the requirements that Georgia is putting in place now to make it harder for African Americans and potentially Latinos to vote would have had to have been pre-cleared by the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department.
Right.
And that pre-clearance requirement was essential because we saw so many actions. Some were not subtle, some were very subtle, but no less unlawful. And that's why Section 5 was such an important bulwark in our voter protection infrastructure. And that's why without it, everybody has to step up. And that's why I've been so actively involved in this. That's why the DNC, through our voter protection program, is so actively involved. And that's why there's so many, Eric Holder's group, so many great lawyers in the private bar, in the civil rights bar. Everybody's actively involved. This is an all-hands-on-deck enterprise. But I'll tell you, the best thing that can happen right now is for people to plan ahead, to make sure they leave nothing to chance. Don't simply show up on election day because without having made sure that you are eligible to vote and everything is in order,
right.
That ounce of prevention is critical because, you know, we have such tremendous opportunity to take back our democracy, Tom, in 22 days. I mean, we could win a dozen governor's races. And with the exception of one or two, and I'm talking about governor's races, where we're flipping a seat currently held by a Republican into Democratic hands.
Right.
In almost all of those cases, the challenge is the following. They're dead heat races. We have the momentum. We have the better candidate. We're fighting for the issues people care about, whether it's health care, education, women's reproductive health, climate, immigration. But you know what? When you have dead heat races and you have this voter suppression going on, and I can talk about North Dakota and what they just did up there. I can talk about Georgia.
Yeah, they just disenfranchised Native Americans.
Yeah,
Tom, we just have a minute and a half till we're going to hit a hard break here. I had a caller to my show last Friday. A sweet woman, sounded just like, you know, a nice progressive, blah-de-blah. Blah. And she said, you know, I'm in Texas, and I worked as a voting officer for 20 years. And I can tell you, if you get a provisional ballot, all you have to do is write your name and address on the outside of the envelope. And not only will that ballot be counted, but you will be automatically re-registered in all 50 states. And I'm like, that is complete BS. It's a complete lie. It's not true. Provisional ballots, you know, 95% of the time are never counted. And she continued to insist this. And then I got a bunch of calls from and tweets from people saying she had called into Stephanie Miller's show before me and said the exact same thing. There is a campaign by Republicans to convince right. Democrats that if you get a placebo ballot, if you get one of these provisional ballots yep. that don't get counted, it's just fine. Don't worry about it. And this is what accounts for redshift. This is why, and we've been seeing this since the giant yeah. voter purge in Florida in the 2000 election, where Jeb Bush did this to hand the election to his brother, you know, throwing 90,000 African-Americans off the vote. People get a provisional ballot, they vote, they think they voted, they tell the exit pollsters, yes, I voted for the Democrats, and suddenly there's a five-point difference between, right. you know, what the exit polls show and what the actual polls show. Is there an institutional or a specific program that the Democratic Party is going to put into place to solve this, sir? We have about 20 seconds.
Yeah, voter protection has to be in place in all 50 states. You're absolutely right that if you cast a provisional ballot, it is all too likely not to be accepted. That is why it's important to go to iwillvote.com. Make sure your registration is in order and you can vote. 22 okay. days till the weekend, folks.
There you go. And what was that toll-free number you gave us again?
1-833-DEM-VOTE.
Dem vote. Okay, 1-833. And that's if you have a voting problem or if you just want to know what's going on.
Anything, any questions.
Any questions.
Be safe.
833-DEM-VOTE. Tom Perez, thank you so much, the chair of the DNC.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to be back in just a minute. Nick Guthman is going to be with us with the Blue Future Progressive Group, and we got a lot to talk about in the next 3 hours, or two and a half. And welcome back. Jim in Littleton, Colorado. Hey, Jim, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, the thing about the airlines.
Mm-hmm.
What it is the government or the military rents a lot of those planes or, you know, gives them money to hold them for them for military purposes. You know, when we have a war and we got to move troops. And if the government didn't give the airlines all this money, right, to reserve these planes, well, we'd have to pay for the upkeep and maintenance of our own airline fleet, which would be a lot of money, too much money. But your ticket would be twice as much if it wasn't for the fact that the government gives the airlines money all the time to keep these planes, basically.
Yeah, I don't believe it, Jim. Can you give me an authoritative source on that?
I've heard it a couple of times on television, and
yeah, I'm very skeptical of this. We move troops around all the time. Sometimes the troops themselves have to pay. Sometimes,
fly around.
Yeah, Jim. If you can get a link, if you can get an actual link, put it on. You know, tweet it to me. I read my Twitter feed. Tweet it to me, and I'd be glad to go off on it. On the air, all about it, but that's just not strong enough to say this is true. Pat in Hawthorne, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Tom, you were talking about Aetna insurance
mm-hmm.
in the beginning?
Yeah.
Okay. My husband was a government employee in the early 80s, and we got Aetna insurance.
Mm-hmm.
They left the state of California. We had to get another insurance company. They said they were losing money, and they could no longer afford to stay in California and have insurance. Later on, they came back into the state and had a senior plan.
Mm. Oh, you're talking Medicare, what's it called, Medicare Advantage?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, they couldn't afford to have a regular insurance plan program, and yet later they were able to come back and have a plan just for seniors?
Well, what most people don't realize, Pat, and I didn't know until just the last year or so, it was Alex, with Social Security Works who informed me about this on the air, and anybody who was listening at that point in time. is that, you know, if you have regular Medicare, the government just, you know, has their 3% overhead and they pay for what they pay for and you get your Medicare. If you go to a Medicare Advantage plan, it goes through a private insurance company. They basically give you the same benefits as regular Medicare, but the Department of Medicare Services, which paid for by you and me with our taxes, actually pays them about 20% more in addition to the benefits that they're giving to us, so that they can cover their profits and their overhead. And this is something that was drilled into Lyndon Johnson's Medicare law in the 80s, and I believe it was in the 80s during the Reagan era, by the Republican Party to open wow. space for these. So Medicare Advantage is massively subsidized by you and me to give massive profits, particularly to United Healthcare. They're the biggest provider because they got the deal with AARP. And it's a scam. It's just a complete scam. And which is why I refuse to have, old enough to be on Medicare. I am on Medicare. And I refuse to participate in these Medicare Advantage plans because, that, you know, it's just further draining the government coffers and hurting Medicare. Pat, thank you. Nick Guthman is on the line with us. He's a progressive organizer and co-founder of Blue Future. You can tweet him at Nick Guthman, G-U-T-H-M-A-N, or at Blue Future Now. The website, ourbluefuture.us. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on with you, and hello to all the audience.
There you go. Thank you. Tell us about your group and how you are working to get young progressives active into the polls. We're seeing just frighteningly low voter participation numbers among people under 35 broadly and under 25 in particular. In some places, 15% of the level of participation that you see among older generations. Some people think this is because, during the Reagan administration, the guidelines for public school curriculum were altered by Bill mm-hmm. Bennett, Reagan's Secretary of Education. Bill Bennett, 360, Sean. Bill Bennett, who famously had this to say back in the day. If I push the button there, it helps. No, maybe not. I guess it's not. It's not going to. Oh, here.
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do. But your crime rate would go down.
I mean, this kind of idiot, another word comes to mind, but yeah. I can't say it on the radio. He's the guy who did away with civics as one of the standards. And so, since the 80s, many of our public schools just simply no longer teach civics. Is that why? I mean, what's going on here and what are you doing to do something about it?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it is, rooted in a long ploy on the other side to limit participation of the people of this country. So what we're doing with Blue Future, we're really excited about. We've been raising money all year and made grants to about 27 students all over the country in some of the most competitive congressional districts. And we made a grant out to them to organize and mobilize their campus for the upcoming election. And so they're focused on two main things as part of our program. The first and most importantly, as you're mentioning, voter registration. And I'm really excited to report just this morning we got report back from all of our organizers across the country. And over the last month, we registered over 5,000 voters. And that, is just a small part of an overall narrative and picture that's been painted that this year in particular, more young people are voting. We need to get those numbers up and we need to do more. But we're excited to be a part of that.
That's
the second
great.
Big thing that folks are focused on is recruiting people to volunteer for the campaigns, because as you said, they're not getting this education about the importance of their vote, about the importance of community organizing, about the importance of getting out and talking to voters about what's important to them. They're not getting that sort of civics lesson in school, and so we're actually connecting them with some of the most progressive campaigns, some of the most competitive campaigns, and putting our students on the ground, giving them the resources and training they need to get out the vote, get out the word about these candidates who are running on a progressive agenda that will really restore some sanity to our politics, as our former president said.
That's great. And people can find out more information about this at ourbluefuture.us. Do I have that right?
Yep, that's correct. And certainly follow us on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram as well, where most of the young folks are these days.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, everything that's going on, and we have to get these numbers up. If young people would vote at the same percentage as boomers all across the country, I don't think there'd be a Republican left in office. I really don't.
Yeah. We totally agree.
Yeah.
We came out with a research report earlier this year highlighting about 13 different democracy reforms that we hope our candidates will spearhead when they get into the Congress.
Great. Nick, I gotta. We're hitting the end of the hour here, but we'll get you back on to talk about that later on. Thank you, Nick.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.